Basically, I set off from Cumbria in England, which is northern part of England on the west coast, and I sailed across to Northern Ireland and filled up at Port Rush, and then sailed across the North Atlantic along the 60th parallel, around the southern tip of Greenland, and then up the west coast of Greenland into Baffin Bay, and then around Baffin Bay into Lancaster Sound. And once in Lancaster Sound, we just continued westwards across Viscount Melville Sound, Parry Channel, and then McClure Sound into the Beaufort Sea. And from there, we travelled down to the Alaskan coastline,
Through the
around Point Barrow,
Cup-Keys.
and then through the Bering Strait to Dutch Harbour. And then from Dutch Harbour, we came over here, the Gulf of Alaska, and then entered the Inner Passage at Cross Strait. And then, what was it, down
Down through
Icy Strait.
Fredericton.
And we've stopped here at Petersburg, which is, delightful.
And what's particularly remarkable about that journey is that was the first ever transit through, is it the McClure Passage?
It's the most northerly route. And even when they were trying to test, say, oil carriers for the North Slope, and they did a thing with the Manhattan, and she was very specially strengthened at great cost, and I think there were something like three icebreakers or four icebreakers in attendance, and they couldn't take her through the McClure Strait. She had to go through the Prince of Wales Strait. So with global warming, now that you can get a small boat like Polar Bound going through, so it just shows you over the course of the last 35 years how the effect has been in the Arctic to considerably melting the ice and the retraction of ice, which is now very serious.
Because your first trip was 35 years ago?
Yes, it was back in the early 80s, and it took me 4 years to get through the Northwest Passage. And 3 of those years I was iced in at a place called Fort Ross at the east end of Bellot Strait. And then when I got out of there, I had to go up the Mackenzie River to Inuvik to repair the boat. And then it took another year still to get out, to get around Point Barrow. And you might remember, I think it was about 88 or 89, that three whales got trapped in Point Barrow. And the icebreakers in attendance there to free them. So that just shows you that short period of time that where you had the ice right up to Point Barrow to now where it's open water for 50 or 60 miles.
And what's that like? You've seen the change. What are the most noticeable differences?
Dramatic.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. The biggest difference, of course, is that there's far less ice now. You no longer really see the heavy polar pack ice, which could have been 15 feet in thickness. Now it's just like gin and tonic ice, where it's 3 feet in thickness that it'll grow to during the winter. And then, of course, this has a tremendous impact on the wildlife. Polar bears are the ones who are going to suffer most because they're reliant on seals. And when it was all frozen over, the seals had to come up, so they had a number of air holes in the ice dotted all around. And the polar bear was pretty good at capturing them because they would somehow know where the polar bear was going to surface and sit over the hole for hours on end and just grab it. So they're going to be the biggest losers in this. And then environmentally, you might say that the oil industry might have a very detrimental impact, especially if there's a spillage or a leak or a catastrophe and they can't cap it and winter comes along and oil is leaking. This stuff's not going to just evaporate or disappear, and the wildlife then will take a huge hit. So that one realizes we've got to have oil and all the rest of it because we all run motor cars and need oil for heating. But I think there's going to have to be very tight safeguards to ensure that if a catastrophe does happen, that one knows how to deal with it, because the Beaufort Sea is deep, and if it's at the end of the season, it's very difficult for men to work in tremendous cold of minus 30, 40, plus the ships, and then if oil is gushing out below the ice, it can be catastrophic. It's as simple as that.
Jane, I want to get you in on this interview too. This is, you were invited along on this trip, and this is the first time David has taken someone along with
him. David has never had any passenger before. I'm not really quite sure whether I've come along in the role of a crew or whether I'm a passenger. But sometimes I think I'm actually being brought along as cook and bottle washer.
What was it like? What was the trip like?
Well, it was, the boat rolls like anything because she's got very little draft. And so we have had quite a number of gales. And I'm reading David's log surreptitiously when he's not looking. I see that he's recorded winds 4, 6, 7, 8 a few times. Privately, I actually thought it was the bottom end of 9, but he's had far more experience than me, so I think I have to believe him probably. And always likes to exaggerate the weather.
What's the daily routine? Get up, cook?
Well, it's not getting up. You're already sort of half up all the night because you've got to look out every couple of hours or less according to whether there's a lot of shipping around. For instance, when we got to the Pribilof Islands, which are on just north of Dutch Harbour, and there were quite a lot of fishing boats there. And it's confusing at night when you sort of see these lights and you're never really quite sure. It should be quite clear. You know, if you see a red light, it's got it passing you the port, but if it's all three lights coming at you. And the fishing boats don't sail like that. They go around in big circles and you really don't know which way they're going. So occasionally David did have to get on the VHF and call them up on Channel 16. But the purpose of the trip,
yeah.
I mean, the whole purpose of the finding the shortest possible route, which they've been searching for, David, was it for about 300 years?
It's always
more?
Been the goal.
It's shorter.
No, since really the 14th century, I suppose, to try and find a passage over the top of Canada and America to tap the rich spice trade in Asia. Because before that, vessels, if they were coming from Europe, had to sail down the North Atlantic, South Atlantic, round Cape Horn, then up the South and North Pacific. And of course, food and water in these old ships wasn't of good quality as it is now. And of course, scurvy was a problem, and the masting and wreckage and all the rest of it. So it was a very daunting task. And if they could find a route through, it would literally knock something like 10,000 miles off the journey.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating the connection that Jane has to
John Franklin. Mm-hmm. Yes, well, he was my father. I've got the family tree at home, and it is a bit complicated to work it out, but my father said that Sir John Franklin was his three greats uncle, and if my father was alive now, was born in 1907, so he'd be 105. So I suppose that makes me, if he was his three greats uncle, then he's my four greats uncle, or I'm his four greats niece. Anyway, I think it's so distant now that you could just say he's a distant relation. But nevertheless, I was very pleased to be invited by David. You know, it's a great privilege to be taken along. And I said to my children, you know, I'm not at all sure if I should go. Our daughter said, Mummy, it's a bit dangerous. I don't think you really, really crazy. My sister said, it's a crazy idea. You must be out of your mind. And our son said, Mummy, I know you're doing an antiques fair in London, but I really think that, you know, you should just cancel it. It's a real privilege to have been invited. And of course you ought to go. And so anyway, I thought about it for 24 hours. And then I sent David an email and said I'd come up to Newcastle and see him.
Did you go back and look at the family history once you knew you were going?
Oh, I got a family tree out. Yeah. And I always get, you know, that spidery writing. And ink blots on the page and so on. I've got it all at home in a nice big book. I think my sister's got the full thing.
Is it Franklin himself? He was searching for the passage and went missing, and for years it was a mystery.
He set off with two ships. David probably knows the story better, but the Erebus and the Terror. And he had quite a history of expeditions, hadn't
he? Yes, Franklin had done two expeditions, basically near Coppermine River, because most of the coastline, I think, was mapped by Dr. Ray, Franklin, and there's quite a few others. And when you think back in those days, coming in at the Hudson Bay, and these people would walk thousands of miles across it, all in this sort of forest and tundra type situation. And they were tough guys. And again, it wasn't always easy to kill game, to eat, and then make fires. They were far tougher than we are now to survive the cold.
Now, you have been caught up in the ice, and what is that like? I mean, sitting around, monotonous?
I've spent quite a few weeks and months just more or less trapped by ice, and it gives you time for thought, because when that happens, if the ice is under pressure, you're always nervous whether the boat is going to succumb. Fortunately, with Polar Bound, she's quite a robust vessel and is designed for that, and she will squeeze upwards. But nevertheless, however strong a boat is, the ice is fantastically powerful, and it's the appendages on the boat, such as the rudder and the propeller, that are very vulnerable. But in Polar Bound, they're in a semi-tunnel, hoping to lessen that possibility. And of course, it would be untrue to say that one is not sort of frightened by it, because when you're out in the middle of nowhere, you know that there can be no rescue or no help. And the ice is creaking away, and it's on the hull, and you can feel the boat move, and it scrapes along the side, and then you'll find that the boat suddenly gives a lurch, and it's either been pushed up a little bit more, which is a relief. And then you wonder how long you're going to be there, because it could be that you're there for a whole year or longer. And the first time when I first came in and I got down to Fort Ross, I was at 2 full years before I could get the boat out of the ice and on its way. So in those days, it was certainly a problem, but I don't think now that would arise unless we get a fluke situation. But what's interesting out of all of this is that the winds seem to be much stronger. When it was all iced over, you just get very light winds and it would be very quiet and silent. Now you can get 35 knots, 40 knots, 50 knots just blow up in literally half an hour, and suddenly you've got a rough sea, a very rough sea that you're having to plow through.
Mm-hmm. Are you're thinking about maybe getting stuck in the ice again on purpose?
Yeah, I want to go back and do the final route, but I don't want to tell you which one it is, because the trouble is that people want to sort of imitate or emulate, and they don't think of these things themselves, but if they hear you're doing it, suddenly you find you've got a whole following wanting to do it. So I'll leave it, and I'll speak to you when I've completed it.
So you've got one more journey or many
more? One
more
journey. Yeah, yes, I expect I'll be back here again, because I like Dutch Harbour and I like this neck of the woods. And also, if I want a bit of sunshine, I can shoot down to San Francisco or Seattle. It's not too far.
Okay. Oh, and you're how old these days, if you don't mind me asking?
70 years and 10.
10, okay.
One's life expectancy over.
Yeah, wow. You've done a lot so far, and more to come.
I hope so. I certainly enjoy it. And I must say that, you know, I would like to thank all the people along the way who've given me so much help and kindness. You know, I meet a lot of kindness, and it does restore one's faith in humanity, because in the papers you read so much of badness and murder and all the rest of it, but I think there's more good people than bad people in the world.
And you go for months on end without seeing anybody, probably, huh?
Quite a few months, yeah. Yes. I think the longest period has been certainly about nearly 6 months.
And the two of you get along okay without talking to anyone else for two?
Haven't pushed me overboard yet. I'm still here.
I've got to keep the cooking. I can't say too much, otherwise I wouldn't get all these fantastic meals.
Well, you've done so many trips without anybody, but this one with Jane.
Yeah, let me put it this way. I'm surviving this one much better than the other ones there when I didn't have to cook for myself. So I think that this is a better combination.
I mean, American, you can always strike this out of your interview, but I've been keeping a log every day. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen pack ice before. I've never even seen an iceberg before. And there's just a little passage here that I appeared out. I'd been having a rest. It was nighttime. David was out on watch and sat up on the bridge there. And he obviously called me, and when I re-emerged, it was like a scene from Dante's Inferno. There was a full gale blowing on the ship's beam, and the entire frozen sea appeared to be on the march, with great rafts of pack ice proceeding with remorseless power on their individual trajectories, some in full sail like huge, delicate lotus flowers, others looking like stacked-up railway sleepers. And then there were fantasies of the funfair, giant girandoles, and gondolas, and rocking ducks, flutes from carnival days, and even a double pedale with circular viewing hole through the centre, for all the world like an old-fashioned plate camera. Grimm's fairy tales and the Land of Oz all intertwined. Then there were Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth creations, and every conceivable resemblance to something or other imaginable. It was barely possible to keep one's balance in the ship. Even the seat behind the wheel felt unsafe. After a few minutes to orientate oneself, I realized that the only rogue pieces of pack ice that needed evasive action were the ones directly in our path. This necessitated disconnecting the self-steering mechanism and then wrestling with Polar Bound's big wheel, which seems to have a mind of its own and goes into a wild swing when I'm behind it. I've never seen such an amazing sight and wouldn't have believed it possible that so many square miles of thick pack ice could be broken up and moved so quickly by the combined action of wind and water. The effect of the heaving mass was like being on the horizontal moving walkway at Heathrow, where disconcertingly you can see fast walkers on the side of you who keep pace and occasionally go even faster. Dawn revealed a huge heaving grey sea with a few of the more cumbersome outriders still marching resolutely on their chosen track in pursuit of their long, now dissolved or relocated companions, with smaller debris scattered across the ocean like the aftermath of a storm in the mountains. It was unbelievably dramatic. Those huge pieces of ice all stacked up like great slabs riding up on top of each other, and the whole lot seemed to be going like a train past us. And in fact, of course, you know, I was been asleep and I came up and the moon was out and it was blowing hard and the whole sea was on the move. It was really frightening. Yeah. But in fact, the only pieces when I began to calm down a bit and realised were actually the bits that were about to sort of likely to cross our path. Because we were actually going faster than they were, weren't we?
Yeah.